I next met with Dr. Sandra Swain, and to begin, she commented on NSABP trial B38, a large phase 3 clinical study of adjuvant chemotherapy she presented for the first time at last year's ASCO meeting.
We looked at 3 different chemotherapy regimens, and it was really, we designed it at the time to be very practical because a lot of people were using dose stents and a lot of people were using TAC, and we also wanted to consider, could we improve on dose stents by adding gemcitabine? So those were the 3 arms. And we did the study in about 5,000 patients with node-positive disease, and it showed that there was absolutely no difference as far as disease-free survival or overall survival in any of the arms. So I think that it's clear that we really are at the point where we're not going to make any more difference, however we sort out the different chemotherapies, however we give the paclitaxel or whatever. And the issue is really the toxicity. So with the dose stents, there's more neuropathy. With the TAC therapy, there was more febrile neutropenia. So it's really a matter of looking at toxicities and deciding how to treat the patient. I think any one of those could be chosen. I, in the past, was using a lot of TAC therapy. I liked it, used it a lot, and found toxicities really to be very, very manageable in patients, and it's done in 6 doses. Some patients, of course, had severe problems with myalgias and asthenia. I know the standard is pretty much in the U.S. to use dose stents, and when Kathy Miller discussed the different abstracts, she said that would be her choice, too. So I think that dose stents is fine. Unfortunately, adding the gemcitabine didn't benefit at all. So where I see things going, as we talked about earlier, looking at the hormone receptor positive disease and the androgen receptors, is really subsetting patients by biology and not doing any of these large nonspecific trials anymore. I think that the end of that era is here for sure.
There was a study at San Antonio I thought was really interesting, and the NSABP was also involved with this, the so-called CALOR study. I thought that was really fascinating. Can you talk about what you all looked at?
Right. And the CALOR study was an international collaboration with the International Breast Cancer Study Group. And I have to give Irene Wapner a lot of credit, who is a surgeon that works with us in the NSABP, who for years tirelessly said we needed to look in the situation where a patient had an in-breast recurrence or a regional recurrence after lumpectomy or mastectomy to see if they needed to get chemotherapy or not, because it was a very unanswered question. And she brought it up over and over again. So we did join with the International Breast Cancer Study Group for the CALOR study. And this study randomized these patients who had these local recurrences, either in the breast or chest wall, to get chemotherapy or not. And they could get hormone therapy if they had ER-positive tumors. And the study only accrued a little over 100 patients, unfortunately, even though it was supposed to accrue hundreds of patients, because doctors all felt like they knew the answer, that either they needed chemotherapy if they had ER-negative disease, or they didn't need it because there was no data and they were resistant. And surprisingly, even with such a small number of patients, there was a very significant result, especially in the patients who had ER-negative disease when they were given chemotherapy. There was an overall survival benefit when they got chemotherapy. So I think this is tremendous data. Unfortunately, it's small, but it does show what we need to do to work together to do these kind of trials and to get answers to these important questions.
So another issue, I almost hate to bring it up because I don't know if people really want to talk about it anymore, but I see that the NSABP B34 cladrinate study was published. And actually, I was really surprised in speaking with Richard Pito that he's doing an individualizing a typical meta-analysis of bisphosphonates, which I thought was really interesting. Where are you right now, and what do you think about the data that's come out over the last few years?
Well, the bisphosphonate data, I think, is very confusing. And it looks like it may be effective for improving outcome in the adjuvant setting in postmenopausal women where you have a low estrogen level. If you looked at the Austrian study, those patients who got 3 years of hormonal therapy with ovarian suppression and got a bisphosphonate, they had a better outcome. But they only got 3 years of hormonal therapy, so that's different than what we would do in standard practice. If you look at the Azure study, that treated patients for a much longer period of time, much more aggressive hormonal therapy. And those patients in that study that benefited were the postmenopausal patients. So the theory is, because the Austrian study treated patients with ovarian suppression, they had no estrogen around, and the Azure study was positive in the postmenopausal women, the patients with low estrogen levels are those that benefit. What I do in practice personally is most postmenopausal women have osteopenia, osteoporosis, but I don't use the bisphosphonates myself in the adjuvant setting. I do discuss it, but I really have not switched over to doing that, and I know some people have. I certainly don't do it in the premenopausal setting, except I admit I have a couple patients in which I have done it because the patients are very well read and they've wanted it, so we've done it. But I'm not convinced about doing it in the premenopausal setting.
Any predictions about what this meta-analysis is going to show?
I think it's probably going to show some benefit, because every time you do a meta-analysis and have more patients, if there's benefit at all, it comes out because you have a lot more power to find it. So I think it probably will. I'm concerned about using it in all these patients, though, because of the potential toxicities with it. And, you know, it's just a lot of things to be giving patients for a long time. We don't even know how long to give bisphosphonates, and people are being put on them for long periods of time.
Continuing on with the theme of adjuvant treatment of HER2-negative disease, let's talk a little bit about an issue the NSABP has been involved with for about a decade, the use of the Oncotype DX assay. How do you use this assay yourself today in your practice?
I use Oncotype for any patient who has a ER-positive, node-negative tumor, for sure. I use it if it's a patient in which I would consider giving chemotherapy. And for those patients with node-positive disease, I have not been using it routinely. I've been trying to get them on the responder trial, which is a trial in which you do the Oncotype, and if it's below 25, then they get randomized to get chemotherapy or not chemotherapy. But I personally haven't been very successful in getting patients on the responder trial, but I think it's a great trial and it'll give us some good answers, because I'm convinced that many patients with node-positive, ER-positive disease do not need chemotherapy. But at the current time, we pretty much give them all chemotherapy. As far as other tests, I have not been routinely using the MammaPrint, for example. I'm doing a study at my institution with a MammaPrint, but I don't use it in routine practice.
When you talk about using it in people with node-negative tumors, the questions I hear sometimes are people with larger tumors and younger women. Does that deter you at all?
I still will use an Oncotype routinely in a patient who is premenopausal, because I think it's about the biology, not so much about the age. And I think a lot of studies have shown that with a lot of different data, and with the data even that Soon Paik presented, there were several or many women that were premenopausal and there was still a difference there, or a spread to low, to intermediate, to high risk. So I will use it in premenopausal women. And there's a very large database of premenopausal women that have had an Oncotype, and I actually presented a poster a couple years ago at San Antonio showing that you do see women with low, intermediate, and high risk.
Let's talk a little bit about HER2-positive disease. And at San Antonio, you presented more data from the CLEOPATRA trial. What have we learned about the multiple analyses that have been done over this past year from the CLEOPATRA study?
Well, there's really only been two presentations of CLEOPATRA, and Jose Bazelga presented the initial primary endpoint, the disease-free survival endpoint, showing a six-month benefit when you added pertuzumab to trastuzumab and docetaxel in first-line metastatic breast cancer. And then I presented the updated survival and confirmatory survival analysis at San Antonio, and it showed a significant survival benefit, which to me is very exciting, and this is first-line disease. The median survival had not been reached for the pertuzumab arm, so a lot of patients were still doing well. And I think that's, again, the exciting thing about all these treatments that we have for HER2-positive disease, that we have totally changed the natural history of this disease. These patients really are surviving longer. I think we question that in ER-negative, ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, where survival is really affected very much by treatment, but it's absolutely clear in HER2-positive disease that we have improved survival.
I did see some, I guess, sub-presentation, so to speak, quality of life and other things from Cleopatra. One thing that I wasn't really on my radar much until I saw a meta-analysis paper about it were dermatologic issues with pertuzumab. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. There was a paper with, I think it was almost a couple thousand patients, and it does show that there are a lot of skin toxicities with pertuzumab. Now, I've used pertuzumab quite a bit myself, and I didn't have that experience at all. So I was kind of shocked by seeing that and seeing the percent. I don't remember what it was, but what is a lot more than I would have thought.
There was also a pilot study, I think it was at a Memorial, looking at pertuzumab, trastuzumab with paclitaxel that kind of gets into this whole issue of what you pair it up with. Any thoughts about that, and what are you doing in your own practice?
A couple of the increased side effects that were seen in the arm with pertuzumab in the Cleopatra study were increased febrile neutropenia. It was increased by about 4 or 5%. And also with that, diarrhea, higher grade diarrhea and mucositis were increased. So the thought is that when you disrupt the mucous membranes with either diarrhea or mucositis, you have more proclivity to have febrile neutropenia. So you do have more toxicity when you add pertuzumab. The thinking was that if you use paclitaxel, for example, instead of docetaxel, that you may have less. But actually, in the Memorial study, they still have a very significant rate of diarrhea and mucositis. So I don't know if that's the answer. So I would think that what we need to do is really, as I said before, when we're talking about the neoadjuvant study, figure out which patients don't need chemotherapy, and then also figure out a better partner for the HER2-targeted therapy where you have less of these problems and potential febrile neutropenia.
What are you using in your own practice?
In my own practice, I would use docetaxel.
So let's talk a little bit about T-DM1, the other big entry into the scene. Can you kind of summarize where we are with that in terms of what came out at San Antonio, what's come out over the past year?
Well, T-DM1, I think, is the darling of the drugs out there now for breast cancer, showing such great activity in the metastatic setting, with the Amelia study results being presented at ESMO showing a survival benefit. And it was in later stage setting, T-DM1 versus lapatinib capecitabine. So that data is great. I've had a patient, and this is just an amazing patient, who was on the Amelia study, and you asked me earlier about oral therapy. Well, she was on the capecitabine lapatinib, had a horrible time. She was taking 19 pills on the trial, could barely choke down the pills, had to take other pills for nausea, had to take other pills for diarrhea. So it was just lots of pills all the time. She lost weight, didn't do well, went off that arm, and then was snuck on to the compassionate use T-DM1. And had brain mets in the past, too. I mean, she had a lot of disease and was a sick patient. She did extremely well and responded to T-DM1 and I think received approximately 26 or so cycles or more of T-DM1. So it's a fabulous drug, and I can say that personally from seeing it, you know, in this patient.
So she had response in the brain?
She didn't have response in the brain, but she didn't progress for a long time, for over a year. And she had had surgery and radiation, and she'd had quite a bit of problems with her brain mets, but she didn't progress.
What have we learned in terms of side effects and toxicity with T-DM1 over the past year, and what's your own clinical experience?
Well, the toxicities are really laboratory-based toxicities. They're lowering of platelets and raising of the liver function tests. And the patient that I mentioned, she actually, with her first cycle, her liver function shot way up and her platelets dropped quite a bit, but the dose was reduced and she did fine, as I said, for over a year. So I think that it's very, very manageable. I know people always say it's manageable, but I really, truly believe that with T-DM1.
What are the trials right now out there that include T-DM1 that you're most excited about?
Well, there's trials that have been completed. There's in, you know, the first line setting, the Marianne study, they're looking at different combinations of T-DM1 with pertuzumab and with chemotherapy. So that will answer one question for us. Can we, you know, substitute T-DM1 for the trastuzumab, for example, and, you know, think about using T-DM1 and pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting in the future. Certainly pertuzumab is being looked at in the adjuvant setting with trastuzumab, but maybe T-DM1 would be better as a partner. So that Marianne will help with that. study too. And then there's the Teresa study where patients were randomized to T-DM1 or best choice that the physician could use. And that study's completed and hasn't reported yet either.
Yeah, that affinity trial looking at pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting is really an attractive. It kind of reminds me of the original adjuvant trastuzumab studies where it seems like the patients would have something to gain, very little to lose. I'm assuming it's accruing extremely well. That's what I've heard.
The affinity trial is accruing extremely rapidly, and I'm sure will close very, very soon in the next few months. And as you said, it's very easy. It's a no-brainer because you're just adding one drug that has really not very much more toxicity.
Any reason to think that either pertuzumab or T-DM1 might not be as effective in the adjuvant setting?
No. You must know something.
No, I don't know anything. I think I've heard people more about T-DM1 and whether you need macroscopic disease in terms of, I don't know exactly.
I think one area of research that we really need is for brain metastasis in HER2-positive disease. You know, there have been some studies looking at lapatinib showing some volumetric changes, but it's clearly not a big winner there. So we really do need to focus on that in the future because even though these patients seem to have less brain mets, and probably because we have much better systemic therapy, they do get the brain metastasis, so we do need some good treatments there.
Anything going on in terms of adjuvant therapy of HER2-positive disease? We've seen over the last few months some data looking at duration, 6 months, 12 months, 2 years. Can you comment on that and anything else that's come out in terms of adjuvant therapy in HER2-positive disease?
Well, at ESMO, two of the trials that looked at the length of treatment of trastuzumab were presented. One, the HERA trial, long-awaited results of 1 versus 2 years, showed no difference at 8 years, which I think was great because I personally didn't want to give patients treatment for 2 years. And then the FARE study, P-H-A-R-E study, the French study, compared 6 months to 1 year. And this study was a non-inferiority trial, and it actually did not show non-inferiority. In fact, I gave the discussion at ESMO. It actually was better to give 12 months versus 6 if you actually look at it statistically. So the standard of treatment is still 12 months of adjuvant trastuzumab.
What are you using as a chemotherapy partner in adjuvant HER2-positive setting? There was a prominent editorial led by Hal Burstein raising the question of whether we're underutilizing anthracyclines, particularly in higher-risk younger women.
I think in women who are higher-risk, younger, as you said, I would use the anthracycline regimens, either the standard weekly regimen or Q2 weeks if you wanted to use the dose-dense part. For older women and women who have node negative disease, I would standardly use TCH or docetaxel carboplatin trastuzumab. And I still use that and still believe in it and still have discussions about that. I had a patient just last week who had a small, little over a centimeter or two, it was a couple centimeters actually, HER2 positive, ER negative tumor. She'd had two other tumors with different biologies in the breast in the past, but it had been years before. But anyway, so she had a small HER2 positive tumor. And what we discussed, she was in her 60s, she didn't want chemotherapy at all. We discussed using the Dana-Farber regimen with paclitaxel and trastuzumab, and that's what she's going to get, weekly paclitaxel with trastuzumab. And I talked to Ian Kropp there about the study they've done, and they haven't reported efficacy. It's a non-randomized study, but he said that they're actually using that as standard in these kind of patients that I described. So I feel comfortable with that because I think the HER2 targeted therapy with trastuzumab is the most important, and also giving it with a very synergistic compound like a taxane or using paclitaxel.
I think that the succeeding strategy or the next strategy they're going to look at is going to be TDM1 compared to that. Does that make sense to you?
TDM1
adjuvant
alone.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's exciting. I mean, we've wanted to do that and we've talked about actually doing that. So I think that's great. And the less chemotherapy we can give to these patients who have these very prominent targets, the better.